Russian zone. And we would get for our troops in that occupied Berlin, we would get all our food would come in on train and unloaded at this depot. And I would have a group of German civilians that would unload that train and put it into cold storage. And that's what I did. And I got to know German people, I think, and I got to know the Russian soldier. I got to know what philosophy the Russian, how a Russian
All right, this is side two, and Glenn's continuing in Berlin.
We were talking about the Russian soldier, and my impressions of him is more of an animal than a person, I think, when they took Berlin. They ravaged the city, stole whatever they could, took whatever women they wanted at any time they wanted, killed whoever they felt like killing, had no consideration for human life. And I don't mean to say the Russian people are that way at all, but the Russian soldiers were. And maybe it's because the Germans did the same thing to the Russians when they were going through the Crimea and getting close to Russia. So maybe I shouldn't be too quick to criticize, but nonetheless, in Berlin, there was a difference between the occupation methods of the American people, or the American soldier and the Russian. And consequently, maybe that all led up to building walls and later on and embargoes and all that kind of stuff. But at that time, there was a lot of animosity between Russians and Americans. We felt pretty good being amongst German people. But when we were in close to the Russian territories, or the Russian sector, we had our guns prepared to fire at all times. Because they wouldn't think nothing about raiding some place and getting some of our food, for instance. We were always prepared for that. And was scared that was going to happen some night. It never did, but... The first winter after the war was tough on the German people. They didn't have no food. They didn't have any men. It was just all women and old men and women and kids. They needed our help in there. They needed our food. I'm glad we were there and was able to help at least our sector of Berlin. And pretty soon, at the end of the winter, it was time for me to come home, and I went to some place in Germany. Don't even know. I don't know where it was. But anyway, I got on a boat, and this time, rather than on a luxury liner that took 5 days to get from Boston to Liverpool. I got on this was a banana, they would haul bananas is what it would do in its peacetime. And it was packed full of troops, and it took us 14 days to go home over the roughest seas that the North Seas has had for quite a while. Just some days we would go further back than we went forward, and we would be sick. It wasn't the worst of my war experiences, but it ranked right up there pretty high. That trip home was terrible. It was lucky we were going home and not going the other way in a boat like that. It was. I'll always remember that little boat. But we landed in New York. landing in New York, the first troops that landed in New York right after the war ended, you know, they got parades and flags flying and people hanging out the way. We didn't, you know, this was 6 months after the war ended, so there wasn't any of that. But it was just getting home and seeing the Statue of Liberty. We saw the Statue of Liberty and when we that morning that we came into New York Harbor, and that was impressive to us. We knew that we had made it. And when we sat back, or when I sit back and analyze, you know, what happened in those 3 years, why, there's really a lot of things that happened that I feel so fortunate that somebody gave me a chance to be a part of that time period, and that I saw a lot of bad things, but I saw a lot of good things too. I saw a lot of good things and a lot of good people, and it made me proud and patriotic. I was before I went, but it reestablished that. And to this day, why, you know, when I hear the Star Spangled Banner, why I get pretty doggone teary-eyed, and I think it's because of my war experience. And I'm glad of that. Well, I'm thankful for that. So I got no complaints. I just got lots of thanks to give to somebody that brought me all through this, and appreciate you sitting here listening to all of this, and hope it does you some good sometime or other. Thank you.
Sure will. I've got some more questions.
Oh, geez, okay.
If you'd like to keep going a little bit.
Sure, go ahead.
Not that there were any gaps or anything, but I'd just like to expand on some things that you said, if possible. What do you think it was, while you're on the front lines, that influenced you to fight, to keep going day to day? So I guess, in other words, what motivated you?
You know, I often wondered that myself. And I think I mentioned that once, that I didn't know whether I had guts enough to kill anybody. I worry about that. I guess that's part of the training period. And you go through the training period. It's not all running and shooting and that kind of stuff. A lot of it is seeing documentaries that the government wants you to see. And those documentaries, I think, help make you motivated to kill. I still can't understand how you can take someone like me, fresh out of Sunday school class, 18 years old, and all of a sudden convince me that I should kill, that I should kill a person that looks like me. One of the motivations there is that you just damn well better do it, or he's going to kill you. I mean, that's a pretty good motivation right there. And I think those training films make you realize that you can think about it if you want to, but you're going to be dead. So killing is and to be motivated. I think the motivation comes a lot just because you believe in your country, and I don't think I've been propagandized into thinking that. I think I sincerely do, and I sincerely was motivated because this Nazism was taking over countries that believed in the same principles that I believed in. So I don't see anything. I guess I didn't see anything wrong. I got so that I could kill. I do. I'm not proud of that. I got so that it didn't bother me to kill. The worst part of it is towards the end of the war, some of those guys that they had in their German army come from other captive countries, that they made them come and get in there, and they really didn't want to fight. And they were just kids like us, and even younger, that maybe even believed the same thing we believed in and wasn't supposed to be there at all. How do you tell those away? How do you tell those kids from, well, those are the kids that's going to give up right away. I mean, they didn't, well, they'll throw down their arms. Americans, when Americans fight and somebody wants to surrender, they can surrender. I mean, they're not going to put their arms down and then stand up and Americans are going to shoot them. A GI just is, he just isn't that kind of a guy. And I guess that's it. But I guess I've asked that question myself quite a bit. How do you motivate? But the motivation to go out and spend that kind of misery in that kind of conditions, in that mud and wet and grime and blood and all of that kind of stuff. And it never bothered me a bit. The mud, I just don't remember that. I can go out and get muddy now, and it does. But I lived in that stuff, and my, geez, I can't believe we did that. We must have been motivated some way or other.
You mentioned that you got to the point where it didn't bother you to kill the enemy. Was it that? Were you at that point right away, or was it a struggle to begin with, and you just got used to it?
I think you get used to it. I got used to it. It's hard for me to say that because I can't visualize me doing that. But you do. You just get used to it. You don't stand over them while they're laying on the ground and shoot them in the face, for one thing. You're shooting them when they're shooting you. That helps quite a bit. That helps being able to shoot them. So it's surprising, especially young kids, teenagers, can acclimate themselves so easily to wartime conditions. I was acclimated. I got actually that month, or that 2 or 3 months up on the front line, I got acclimated to the front line. It was just a day-to-day living experience. And it's hard to believe now, but you do. You're scared all the time. You're just scared completely all the time.
And, you know, if you don't feel you can answer any of these questions, don't feel like you have to. You can pass. But, can you talk a little bit about what it was like to have friends that were missing or killed?
Yeah, I can't talk about it because I wasn't with anybody long enough to be that close to them. I've had a couple buddies that I probably was, and they got shot and they got hurt, but they got well, and I talked to them after the war. But to have I have a good friend die right beside me, I guess I never had that happen. Not a good friend, not a buddy. I just didn't know him long enough to call him a buddy. He was an American soldier, though. And I felt badly about that. But that's all he was, mostly because I was a replacement. I never had any friends. I never had time to have friends. And when I was online and needed friends, well, then all of a sudden I was shot and I was gone again and I didn't have any friends then either. But I did. I just didn't know it. They were closer than I thought. The people back in a hospital, for instance, they were friends. Or the people that opened that door in Belgium, they were friends.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview loneliness. Do you think maybe your position as a replacement affected that? You know, you mentioned you said you didn't feel like you had close buddies.
Absolutely. That's what made it. Yeah. That's why I was lonely. I would still been scared even if I'd joined my company here in the States and trained with my company in the States and then went to war with the same guys. I was still been scared, but I wouldn't have been lonely. But I was lonely. I didn't, you know, there were times where I would look around and I couldn't find anybody I knew. And nobody knew me. I could look around and see somebody killed and I didn't know what his name was. That's loneliness. And it's something else, I guess you get acclimated to it. I don't know, I got used to it. And, you know, you don't take long to make pretty close friends in those kind of conditions. So, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, I was always, never had anybody to talk to. There was always somebody there for you. And always other people wanted to talk to you and be with you and all that. I'm not saying that. It's just that down inside you're here so lonely.
Along with that loneliness, you mentioned fear was the other major emotion you felt. What do you think was your single greatest fear?
I guess maybe my single greatest fear was being killed or mortally wounded there that night in Belgium, where nobody knew where I was. I was no place. I was nothing. I was in Belgium and nobody knew it. I would have just disappeared from the earth if I had died there. I wanted to come home. And it was my first experience, and it was, the setting was just right for fear. I mean, you could hear the rumble of guns some distance away. You know, we didn't know how far away it was. It's probably quite a ways, but it seemed like a half a mile. But it was probably 10 miles. And it was just, fear is a funny thing. It leaves you and comes back to you in a moment's notice. But that was, I think that's a good time. And any other time was as we were nearing the front line and seeing dead Americans passing all dead Americans in a stack. And it's just a matter of fact that these guys are all dead. I mean, they're just dead, and they were just like we were just yesterday. And we were going into that area, and we'd have no idea what kind of what combat was. And I don't know. Fear don't get much worse than that, I guess.
How would you describe your feelings toward the enemy? For example, in the Pacific front, there was, I think, a real bitterness between the Americans and their enemy over there. What did you feel towards your enemy?
I think there probably is a difference there, all right. I had a certain respect for the German people and the German army. Not Nazism, but the German people. The German people were the most advanced, had the most advanced society in Europe, as far as where their homes were and their technology and their homes and all that kind of stuff. And the German people were an awful lot like we are, I thought. The German people were indoctrinated to not to believe in Americans, certainly. But and the German army, I think there's a way to fight a war and a way it isn't. I don't think the Japanese fought the kind of war that I'd like to fight in. I'm glad I went to Europe instead of Japan. Japan. It's more of a conventional, if you can call war conventional. Why? It's more conventional war. Although, when you talk about how bad war is, my experience isn't as bad as it must have been in World War One. In that trench warfare, geez, that was something else again. Those guys, I think, I don't know that I would have committed through that or not. That was awful. But there weren't a lot of people involved there, though. There was, you know, we had a lot of troops over there, but not like we had in World War II. I think that's one of the reasons why you're so excited about serving your country, because everybody else is. Geez, everybody was in service. Only guys that weren't in service are, you know, guys that are physically unfit or guys that had to stay home and farm, of which I could have been. I had that chance to stay home and farm, and I'm glad I didn't. I would probably have been richer than if I did, but I didn't. I guess maybe I get a richer experience. I've had a richer opportunity to talk to my grandson about something like this. Anyway, so it's you asked about respect. The German army, they had a good army. They had a good army until it was infiltrated with a lot of people that didn't really want to fight. They had a ripping good army before, and as they went, when they took France over to start with, I know that.
You mentioned being an impressionable 18-year-old with kind of a gung-ho, heroic attitude, particularly going into training. Did you feel like when you actually did face combat, did you feel like you were well-trained tactically for that?
Yeah, I always felt like we had been taught well. I always felt that we had as good a weapons as they did. I never had any complaints about, well, you know, the Army, we complain all the time. I don't want to give you the impression that I never complained, because I complained all the time. But when you really get down to the nuts and bolts of it, we as a whole didn't have much to complain about. They always got food up to us. We never was without. You know, I hear over the news today that they don't have enough ammunition in Iraq. God, I can't believe that. I mean, something's wrong someplace. We were never without ammunition, and we used a lot of it. We used a lot of it recklessly, and not all of it found its home in a German. I tell you that much. We'd shoot at rabbits and chickens and everything we wanted to shoot at. But again, 18-year-olds, give them a rifle and teach them to shoot. Why, they're going to shoot something. But I really do. I kind of felt proud of our army. I complain about it all the time, but I think they did it. I think they did a pretty decent kind of a job.
Switching gears just a little bit, how did you stay in touch with your family, and what did it feel like to be away?
I didn't miss being away, I don't think. Because I wasn't being away from anybody but my folks. I had a girlfriend, well, I probably would have missed her. And I didn't feel like I was being away. I didn't miss being away because everybody else was away too. Today, I guess, if I was away, I'd miss it because not everybody else is away. You're the only one that's over there in Iraq fighting almost all by yourself. I don't know. my contact was probably pretty minimal. For one thing, it's more than just a nuisance to write a letter in a foxhole with mud all around you. But that's forgiving. I mean, so they didn't get any letters from me. My folks knew that I was in a war area. And they worried a lot, and there wasn't anything I could write to make them feel better. They would write me, but I'd move around so much, and being a replacement, my address was changed around so much I'd never get any letters. When the letters never did catch up with me, well, I'd have a whole stack of old stale letters. So I didn't get much mail. So my contact was very minimal. And I never knew how important it was, though, for my mother. And the contact, and then after the war, when I could make contact, because there was a time there that we could go and send a telegram home. And she really appreciated that after the war ended. But otherwise, we would write a letter, and it was, you know, you'd have to give it to an officer and have him read it. And then he'd cross off the places that indicated that if the enemy ever found it, why, it'd give some information to him. So sometimes the letter would be all caught up and everything. So I didn't write as much as I should. Certainly didn't write every day, I know that. I suppose in those months of combat, well, I probably wrote 4 or 5 letters. That's about it. I can't be very proud of that.
Were you awarded any medals or citations, and how did you get them?
I was awarded some stuff that was given to me by doing something dumb. The 20 people that went down that hill and got cut off in Koslar was all awarded the presidential citation. Well, that was a dumb thing to do. We lost contact with our flanks, and we went in and got cut off. We didn't do anything except hide from the enemy in there and go through the basements of the civilians that used to live there, hoping that they'd have some canned fruit to eat and that kind of stuff. That hardly is a case of heroism. Certainly my Purple Heart was no heroic action. It was anything but that. I was awarded a Bronze Star for being a part of that same unit that was also involved with the shooting of the people jumping over your head. We got, and that was the dumbest thing. We were awarded a Bronze Star because we all went to sleep that night. You know, that's not very brave. We woke up scared to death, and we fired as fast as we could, and we awarded a Bronze Star for it. There was a lot of people that were more heroic than I. Maybe the most heroic thing I did was to open that door in Belgium. Stand in front of that door in Belgium, not knowing what in the world is going to be on the other side. That to me, as I thought about that afterwards, that was almost heroic.
Now, when you came home, what was the readjustment to civilian life like when you returned?
Oh, it's kind of funny. I was only 21. I wasn't ready to settle down. The government gave us good benefits to go to school. And to all the girls, we were heroes. So that, you know, that was kind of fun. Parents or close relatives were told that you shouldn't talk about war experiences. So they didn't talk about it too much, which was kind of funny, I thought, but it didn't bother me any. But I didn't have a very difficult time, I don't think, in adjusting. Going to school was, I don't know if I felt like I deserved a few years out having fun or not, but that's what I did. That's what I did when I went to school. I wasn't a very good student, and I still didn't know what I was going to do, but turned out, I guess.
Did you find any of your relationships with your family had changed when you came back?
Oh, no. My little sister grew up, and my baby brother, who was in the process of growing up, I guess I realized when I got back and told me that how tough it was on a mother. If anybody should have got medals for kids that, like me, went overseas, why should have been mothers rather than the people that messed around getting shot? They're the ones that really worried and suffered more than anybody.
Could you talk a little more in depth of how you made use of the GI Bill? In what ways you use that?
The GI Bill, there was a farming part of it that was available to young farmers. And I don't know enough about it to talk about it, I guess, because I didn't take advantage of it. I went to school instead and used the GI Bill in school. They paid my tuition, and I guess that's all they paid. They paid my tuition, and I think the fact that I was a veteran, I got a job at a dormitory, at a waiter at a dormitory, and also then, because I was a veteran, why I got a job, when that got my food paid for, and my rent was paid because I got a job as athletic proctor for the quadrangle at the University of Iowa. And that was kind of fun.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about even after your return, kind of the long term. Do you feel like your military experience influences still even your thinking about war or about the military in general?
Sure, I guess so. I feel like probably because I went through World War II that I'm an expert on international affairs, which obviously I'm not. But I'm certainly a critic of the way things are done here and there now in war. I never could understand the way they fought a war in Korea or in Vietnam or in the Near East, any of those places. So it makes me more involved as international politics, I guess. It certainly doesn't, I don't feel that it makes me an expert. they'll never fight a war like I was in before. It won't be fought that way. So it'll be different, and I guess it'll probably be more deadly yet than this. But it seems like it's the civilians are the ones that take the brunt of war rather than the soldier. It's too bad that we can't live in peace. But we could get into politics here, and that's, you know, and that's not what we're here to talk about, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, we can head into that direction a little bit. Do you feel like your military experience influences you politically? I guess this is kind of a building off that last question.
I don't know that it should. My military experience. Yeah. No, I guess I fought a war where military experience showed me what unconditional surrender means. And our governments since that time have discontinued the use of that completely. I don't think there is such a thing as a compromise peace like we have been going through. I think we did it right in World War II.
Kind of a hypothetical question here. How do you think your life might have been different if you hadn't served in the military and hadn't been a part of World War II?
Well, I would have, obviously, if I hadn't gone to World War II, I would have farmed in partnership with my dad. And in those war years, why farming and especially livestock producing was very lucrative. It really was pretty good. I hope that if I would have stayed here, why I would have made a lot of money. But I'm not saying at all that I think that's what I wished I'd done. But that could have been a possibility. I would have, and obviously, you know, when you change your life pattern that much, hypothetically, why you'd marry different, and you wouldn't have the kind of grandchildren that we have now or anything else.
Tom Brokaw, in a very famous book of his, labeled your generation the greatest generation. How do you feel about
that? I'm always proud of that. Jeez, I'm proud of that. You know, we had Tom Brokaw when I was president of Sioux County Cattle Feeders. You know, this had anything to do with World War II, but we were lucky enough to get him back as our speaker 1 year. And ever since that time, I was probably a fan of Tom Brokaw. And when he published his book and came out with that, I agreed with him. I thought it was too. I thought it was really a great generation. We went through everything from a depression to being attacked by foreign countries, and a world war, and the different economies that follow World War II, and I don't know, all the technology change that this generation has been fortunate enough to be involved with. Well, geez, I'm proud to be part of the greatest generation, and I agree with him.
All right. Well, about all my questions, if you can believe that.
Well, Jesus, Adam, it's my bedtime, I'll tell you that much.
Well, before we turn off this recorder, is there anything else that you'd like to add that I didn't think of asking or that you didn't get to?
There's one question that you never got to that I guess I'm surprised that you didn't ask. And that is the relationship between a occupying army and the civilians, that especially girls, that have no boyfriends now and have no husbands and are by themselves. And that's always interesting. Well, you know, that's certainly a touchy situation for a talk about, and I certainly don't want to commit myself to anything here, but the Army, when the war was over and the occupation army took over, where the Army declared absolutely no fraternization, non-fraternization. Do not talk to any German person. Do not talk to them. And if they talk to you, turn around, don't kill them, or just don't talk to them. Well, Jesus, here you are. You got 10 million American GIs all full of testosterone and you send over there and you put all that stuff that'll calm that stuff down in their drinking water while in their canteens while they're fighting a war. But the war is over with now, and they're back to being young men again. How in the world do you keep fraternization from happening? And it happens. I mean, it just happens. And the government, and I think people in general, kind of take it upon themselves just to ignore that. I mean, I think the government says, oh, that really didn't happen. They don't fraternize. They don't have anything to do with one another. The GI and a pretty German girl, they won't pay no attention to each other. Well, Jesus, that's just not the case. That wasn't the case. And it's funny to me that I guess nobody ever mentions that. So there was fraternization, but it wasn't. That's what it was. It's fraternization. It wasn't the raping of German people or anything like that. And I'm proud of that. But you just don't get an American boy say, don't pay no attention to no girls. That just doesn't happen. So I always thought that was kind of funny.
All right. Is there anything else you wanted to throw in there?
No, I don't want to carry that any further, and I don't want to have you ask any further questions on that line.
Oh, I won't. Anything else?
If something comes up, give me the opportunity to say, hey, I forgot something. Maybe I'll wake up tonight and think of something else. But geez, I think we've covered it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for helping me out with this, and I think this is something that we'll be able to pass down to further generations that will get to know a little bit more about their great-grandpa or their great-great-grandpa or whatever it may be.
That'd be fun I'd be fun to think that someday somebody would be listening to that again. Great.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
This ends the interview.